You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello hosting the Ask the Lawyer program on Radio Maria here in Canada from our Radio Maria studios here in Toronto. Today, the program that we're going to discuss in terms of legal theme is going to be the theme of family law, which I know has been requested by so many of our listeners. And we have the pleasure today to have in our studio another lawyer, Dominic Campione. Dominic, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, to Radio Maria, Joseph, and it's my pleasure to be here.
So Dominic is a lawyer of 37 years practice, who has done a fair bit of family law over many years. And today we're going to talk about family law. So now we're going to move on to the theme today, the first time we've done a broadcast in English on family law. And Dominic, I wanted to, the first thing I wanted to perhaps raise with you, or maybe we can discuss, is because in some of the programs that we've done in Radio Maria, we've talked in the past about how in Canada here, we have something called the Canadian Constitution, Charter, Bill of Rights. Right. And it's not like other countries like in Italy, which is a unitary state, or other countries. Our system here is more like the American system, where we have powers divided between, and obligations, of course, were divided between the federal and the provincial governments. So when we talk about family law, it's such a wide-ranging term. Is there just one law, or is it a shared situation? How do you deal with family law issues?
All right. Well, in Canada, family law is primarily statute based, and the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal government is the one that handles marriage and divorce. All right, under the Constitution Act in 1867, and it's legislated under the Divorce Act. So it's a national federal divorce act.
So there's actual national standards when we're talking in particular about divorce.
That's right.
The famous divorce mechanism, because as you and I both know, the reason, I guess, that this is a theme that interests so many people, and this would be people who are younger, middle-aged, or older, is that, if I'm not wrong, roughly 2 out of every 5 marriages end up in divorce. And that would be the case whether you're Catholic or not Catholic,
yeah,
right?
That's correct. The statistics show that the average statistic between, I believe, 2004 to 2011, Statistics Canada, that the chances of divorce for marriages under 30% is approximately 38 to 41%. All right.
So we're right there. So this is something that we should all know about, but impacts so many people's lives.
Well, it impacts because people enter into a marriage with love, embracing good faith, binding obligations, etc., and in a joyous occasion. And unfortunately, sometimes things happen and causing marriage breakdown. But coming back to the constitutional, although it's a national divorce act, it's a federal statute that deals with custodial and access matters and spousal and child support during and after divorce, there is an exclusive jurisdiction when it comes to property rights and rights dealing with property division and adoption, custody and access under provincial jurisdiction. So in speaking for Ontario, as I'm licensed to practice in the Law Society of Ontario, the jurisdiction on with respect to property division or property rights and custody and access as to that legislation falls under provincial statute, but divorce itself, in other words, the actual act of formalizing the marriage breakdown, is under a federal statute.
Yeah, and this is very important because we'll have a lot of listeners, because this is, as I call, an internet-based wide application. Believe it or not, I have a lady from Alberta who always listens to us early in the morning. She always comments and writes to us. And it's true that, and people don't realize that some of the things we're talking about, certainly with respect to property, and that would be very Ontario-based, and every province is different. And of course, it underlines, I think, once again, why it is so important for people who find themselves perhaps in this kind of situation, the importance of legal advice. Would you agree with me on that?
100%. And it's as I said, it's provincial as to property rights. It's important that that the person abide by that jurisdiction. And you can't ask anything better than getting legal advice before you make a step.
Yeah. Now, Dominic, you know, sometimes the comments are going, we know that our society... everywhere in what I would call the Western world in particular, sees many more examples of what we call people living together or common law relationships, which are not technically being married. So, and I know that there's an urban legend, as I call it, in Italian, we have a different phrase, but, an urban legend that, that actually today it doesn't make any difference whether you're married or not. It's all the same. Is that basically false in terms of family law?
There is some truth in it, but it's not. Why I say truth? Because there are rights and obligations where people who cohabit together live in some form of common law relationship. They have certain rights under the Family Law Act, all right?
Right.
Which questions of support, all right? Spousal support or child support. In order to the definition of spouse under the Family Law Act is one where which gives rise to is people who have, I should say, the rights of support. If people have been living in a relationship of some permanence for at least 3 years, there are certain rights of support that follow. Or out of that relationship, of that common law relation, there's a child that's born, there are child support and spousal support obligations. However,
there's no property rights in Ontario if you're not married, right?
There are no property rights. However, the courts are looking at it from a point of view of what is called certain tenements of unjust enrichment,
right?
Constructive trust, where situations could arise where the properties are all in a husband's name, for example, and the wife has given a common law wife has taken care of the farm, taken care of the children, given all her best, saved her money in the sense of helping the family venture, etc. Is it just at that time for a person, for that wife who's living in common law, not to get some form of division or compensation? Or
recognition of the contribution.
Restitution, that's right.
Yeah. So, you know, Dominic, so there's definitely a distinction in at least face value in theory between a couple that gets married or doesn't get married. So I guess the thing is the whole idea of with the Family Law Act, which is a whole, really actually a modern law. Would you not agree with me? Because I remember I got called to the bar in 1979. You got called in 81. So it means I went to law school from 74 to 77.
Right.
I think the Family Law Act came into effect in...
Well, they start drafting 1978. It was probably the most, one of the most change-worthy law, if I can put that. That had a lot of good merit and continues to have good merit in it.
Right.
It was a big step for Ontario to pass the legislation, the Family Law Act.
Yeah, so it's really critical that anybody who's, let's say, maybe not as old or a lawyer as old as myself, but certainly all the younger lawyers would know about the Family Law Act and its importance, and especially living in Ontario. Yeah. So I guess the one thing that happens in people, and of course, as we all know, because the statistic that we quoted of 40%, it's like everybody has like a sibling, a child, a grandchild, a parent, a close friend, a cousin who is touched by this dynamic where the relationship breaks apart.
That's right.
So you as a lawyer, and you do more, much more work than I would do in this field. What actually occurs on a practical level if somebody comes to you and says, Mr. Campione, you know, I'm having problems with my spouse and so on. How do you deal with that, practically speaking, with a client? Like, what do you do?
All right.
Because, you know, a lot of people are listening to us. I mean, we should be very honest. Yeah. I mean, we all know that when you go to a lawyer, it's not cheap, right? I mean, we know these things cost money. There's all kinds of overheads and things that we have to do. And of course, a lot of these family law issues, as we all know, we can read about it in the papers, especially with all the Hollywood stars and so on that are widely publicized, can be very expensive. And people are always, I think, very concerned because, you know, that's such a small portion of the people. But when they read it, they wonder, oh my God, is this my financial ruin because I don't get along with my spouse anymore for whatever reason? How do you treat the, on a human level, let's say?
If I may, before I answer that question, we're talking about the law in Ontario, at least I'll address that issue.
Yes.
And I was caught when I studied the Family Law Act of the preamble to the Family Law Act.
Hmm.
And that reads as follows, and it's very important. Whereas it is desirable to encourage and strengthen the role of the family, and whereas for that purpose it is necessary to recognize the equal position of spouses as individuals within the marriage and to recognize marriage as a form of partnership. And whereas in support of such recognition, it is necessary to provide in law for the orderly and equitable settlement of the affairs of the spouses upon the breakdown of the partnership. So people join in. Not only do they make a vow before God on a marriage, but there are laws and obligations that come with that vow, right? And it is a partnership.
So it's not just the for better or for worse routine.
That's correct. All right. Now, to answer your question, the duty of a lawyer when a client first comes in is to ask that individual, is there any hope of reconciliation?
Oh, that's an interesting statement, because a lot of people think, I go to the lawyer because everything is ruined, and now how are the pieces going to get picked up, right?
Well, I practice in that way, and the reason I say this is because when you do an application for a divorce, you're obligated as a barrister or solicitor, lawyer, to sign your name and make a statement that reconciliation is not possible. Let's put it in this way, all right? So, and of course, when a client comes in, you obtain all the facts, all the issues, the date of marriage, the date of separation, any children, incomes, tax returns, what is a reason for the marriage breakdown, right? In order to have rights under the Divorce Act, there are reasons, there are grounds in order to get for divorce. But coming back again, it is a duty on the part of a lawyer to explore reconciliation and even advise of family counselings that are around, all right?
So you're saying like the Family Law Act, the preamble, notwithstanding all the technical issues that we'll maybe talk a little bit more in detail, that the preamble really does recognize the importance, the central role of the family in our society.
Correct. Yeah.
And however that's defined. And so as a lawyer, you really are seeking to encourage that the family per se be maintained if possible.
Yeah. But it is a requirement. It is not that we have to go to extreme. Undoubtedly, a lawyer's obligation is to follow the instructions of the client and according to the law, right? So if there has been abuse, or the marriage is to the extent that the continuation of that living relationship is intolerable, which would render reconciliation impossible, you have a ground for divorce.
Right. Now, some people think that, well, if I if I wake up tomorrow morning and I decide my spouse, I don't love my spouse anymore, so I can come in to see you, I can, you know, just apply for a divorce. It's sort of like applying for, I don't know what, like, to be really simple, like going shopping or something. I just fill in a, or maybe I order something on the internet and I just get a divorce. Is it that simple, Dominic? Or?
Well, it's not as simple. I'll answer that question by saying, is it a very simple thing just to get married, depending on its culture? You know, it's not only is it expensive, it's a commitment that you make for a lifetime, et cetera, yeah?
Right.
For ill or worse, you know? Yeah. But yes, there are forms of trying to expedite, when I say divorce cases, when it's understood that that situation, that marriage relationship can no longer continue. There are applications that are called joint applications for divorce, et cetera. But of course, paramount to all of that is, again, the question that I said at the beginning, is reconciliation possible? If the client tells me no, definitely no, and justifiable reasons, then we will proceed to obtain the information and make the appropriate application.
Now, if you're separated from your spouse, that this, this marriage breakdown has
which
occurred,
is another ground, yeah. Minimum of 1 year.
It's a minimum. That's what I wanted to ask you. It's a minimum of 1 year.
Yeah. Minimum 1 year from the time that the divorce is granted. All right. So, you can live separate and apart.
Right.
Because living separate apart is also based on intention and fact, under the same roof, 6 months before, but your application commences, all right? But by the time the divorce is granted, 1 year has transpired.
Yeah, so it's not something, like I said, you just apply online and it arrives.
No,
it's much more extensive.
To answer your question, just come in and fill out a paper. No, there are grounds and justifiable grounds in order to make an application for a divorce.
Okay, great. So looking at a 1 year, quote unquote, maybe separation basis as a good starting point.
A minimum
absent,
of 1 year.
Yeah, minimum 1 year absent. Like you said, there might be some special considerations.
That's correct.
That are involved. Now, you said something very interesting, this idea about living separate and apart.
Mm-hmm.
And from everything one reads in general about marriage and relational breakdown, I lost my train of thought. 1 second. The living separate and apart, the literature seems to indicate that a lot of times what happens when people split is that, in fact, they actually both become more poor economically, right? Is that a fair comment? And if so, what I've seen is sometimes people are under the same roof, but they don't sleep in the same room and so on.
That's right. This
living separate and apart? How does the law deal with this kind of situation? Especially in today's world where, in Toronto in particular, where, for example, if you had a couple who had a home, they may have a big mortgage and it may not be so easy just to say, I'm going to leave and see around.
Well, I mentioned earlier that living separate and apart, even under the same roof, I mean, is a question of fact and a question of intention. Mm-hmm. If a couple do not treat themselves as a married couple or as husband and wife, whether they take the top floor and the bottom floor, or even to the public, they're not going to the actual social functions. It's that you have to social functions as husband and wife. It's being communicated. It's a fact, right? So the date of what is important is the date of separation. The date of separation, which is called the valuation date, is where everything is crystallized and divided according to what the preamble said. If you remember, a partnership, right, as an equalization that happens at that time. Now, maybe that might be part of another discussion in the future.
Right.
But living separate and apart is a question of fact, and the minimum requirement is 1 year.
Now, another thing I think that, and I think this people may be shaped by what they see on television, or we see a lot of American TV. You know, we've grown up with it. And one of the things that people seem to think, and I don't, maybe you can comment on it, is that, first of all, I don't have to give a divorce of my spouse if I don't want to, and nobody can force me. And second of all, I especially wouldn't do it when it's all his or her fault.
Yeah.
So this whole question of fault and not being a party to a divorce, how do you deal with those kinds of situations?
Well, that's why there is a divorce act. All right, the divorce act gives grounds for divorce. Mm-hmm. It's not up to one spouse to say no. It's up to proving the ground and if the reason for the divorce, a ground such as a minimum of 1 year or a situation for abuse or whatever, or mental or physical abuse that renders the marriage intolerable to continue. You establish that ground so the husband or the wife can't say, I'm not going to give you a divorce. You're entitled to that divorce. And you're entitled to the rights that come with it, whether it's spousal, child support if their children involved, an equal division of property or an unequal division of property. So, if you talk to Hollywood's style, no, I'm not going to give you a divorce. It's no. If you have the grounds, you're able to prove the grounds, you're entitled to it.
Yeah. So this is very different, for example, for what, many of our listeners who are, of course, Roman Catholic would appreciate as what we would call canon law or ecclesiastical law, mm-hmm. which we'll say maybe existed and continues to exist side by side our old English common law in particular. So we know that under the tenets of the Roman Catholic faith, there is not really any quote-unquote divorce that is permitted as a Roman Catholic. There may be some question of divorce under the Jewish religions and
Correct.
Certain traditions. Certainly under the Muslim faith, there are some aspects that are, of course, religiously related. In the Roman Catholic faith, I guess, it really has been more the issue that marriage really is forever and you can't get divorced. So people I know, from talking with people over the years, they always say, and especially if they tend to be people of faith and a marriage does break down, and what we're talking about is a civil society here that we live in and the civil rules. But people think, well, should I not be able to get a divorce if I'm a Roman Catholic from the Catholic faith? But there actually isn't really divorce. There's a process called annulment under the Catholic ecclesiastical or common law. So Dominic, does that idea of annulment exist in the civil law too?
Well, what exists is questions of void and invalid marriages. And in that angle, it does. There is a procedure with respect to annulments, but it's more ecclesiastical, if I can say it that way. And you got to go to your faith to get that. But a marriage that is not made in good faith, right? That is made, for example, for other purposes.
Yeah, maybe under the pressure of parents.
For a question of...
Because they were expecting a child and they felt they had to get married, right?
Yeah. I'm not saying... I know you're an expert in immigration. For immigration purposes, what is not for marriage, you try to set it aside and all that. And there's a whole procedure for that.
Yeah. So that's the... that's important to recognize because I know that I have seen facts, as you mentioned, in immigration law. Unfortunately, we see the importance of family law when we see, I remember one time I had a young lady from India who was the daughter of a very fine client of mine, and she got married to this gentleman, and no sooner had he arrived here in Toronto that he promptly disappeared from the scene and was widely suspected to already have had another relationship along the way. And I remember the family, and of course this is not a, they weren't Christian. They weren't Roman Catholic. They were Hindu, but in all the religions, and there is this aspect of annulment, and it was amazing because maybe in a more conservative society, being divorced is seen negatively, and this is where the issue of fault comes in, right? Oh, if you got divorced, you are a bad person, or you must have done something wrong. It's never a one-way street, and so annulment would be important, which is even recognized in the Immigration Act. For this family, they wanted to consider annulment because even though divorce would have been more simple, because of the shame associated with it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a reality of it. And I know I have seen people who said that they wanted to proceed on that basis, but it's not easy, right? No. It's not a simple procedure.
It's not a simple procedure. And sometimes people out of that, whether it's for desperation or for other reasons, they proceed with a normal civil divorce afterwards. But there is a lot of, depending on the culture that you have been brought up and the societal environment, of the so-called shame that goes on with respect to divorce. But keep in mind, though, living in a marriage that where there is mental and physical abuse, that it is so intolerable to continue.
Yeah, it's not considered acceptable conduct.
It's not healthy. It's not healthy for anyone, right. You know? Especially if there are children involved, you know.
Well, this is, we're going to take a quick little break, and we're going to carry back. And I would like to carry on after our quick break to discuss exactly, Dominic, what you just mentioned. We're going to talk about children and marriage/divorce.
You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now continue with the program, Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Joe Martinello here in the Radio Maria studio with Dominic Campione, talking today about a new theme for us, the theme of family law. And before, I just wanted to remind our listeners again that if they have any comments or question, we encourage you to call. There's no question or comment too silly to listen to or to respond to. It's area code 416, and the phone number is 245-1534. That's here in Toronto, area code 416-245-1534. So we've been discussing how this term family law relates, of course, on a constitutional basis. There's divisions between provincial and the federal government. We talked about marriage, a little bit about annulment, divorce. And of course, one of the large aspects that affects so many people, no matter what age we are. We mentioned before about the 40% of families basically going through a divorce situation. And so all of us have parents, grandparents, children, siblings, nephews, nieces, close friends, workers, and so on that have to meet the challenge of a marriage breakdown that has it affects their lives. And of course, what oftentimes happens is, unfortunately, is the people who are most affected, obviously between the couple, because I guess, Dominic, at the end of the day, a marriage breakdown is a breakdown in communication, right? This is the big theme when you get married. It's also the theme afterwards and ongoing. But the people who are most impacted are children. I think that they're, and so whether they're our grandchildren or our nephews or nieces, it seems like the children are just sitting on the side there. And so how does the family law deal with and recognize the situation of children in a separation and or divorce?
Well, seeing from beginning to end, when the client first comes in with children or being involved with the children to actual finishing a trial and children afterwards, It is a traumatic effect, not only on the couple who is getting separated or divorced, but also on the children. It's like a roller coaster ride. But when we're dealing with children, we're not just dealing with an asset, a property division. We're dealing with human beings, feelings, emotions, father and mother figures, their role in their play. But we're also dealing with, on when it comes to a marriage breakdown, issues of custody, issues of access, issues of support, both child support and spousal support. There's a lot of things that are involved. But the test that is used when we're talking about children is when it comes to custody and access and also support, because the support the child would get into the table amounts of child support guidelines. But it's what is in the best interest of the child.
Yeah, and I think it's important what you just mentioned, what's in the best interest of the child. They're not just this piece of property sitting on the side that we're going to divvy up or something. And of course, I would think that actually, although as you said, it's statute-based, but it's actually, it really is a tradition that goes back to Roman times, right? There's this Latin phrase that we use all the time, parens, patriae, jurisdiction, you know? Whenever we want to show how smart we are as lawyers, we throw in a few Latin words. So some of us, I don't know about you, Dominic, I studied it for 5 years and yeah. I was a Latin scholar, I think. But anyways, so you use the words parens patriae, you know, all the younger people, their eyes glaze over. They don't, but it really means that, you know, you're the parent of the people. And I guess the law, and it certainly is a concept, certainly that I know from the time of 2000 years ago from the Roman Republic, that the courts, they had this overriding authority to take care of people in need within their own jurisdiction, in this case, in Ontario. So you've mentioned that we don't want to treat them like property. There's custody, there's access.
There's support.
So is it fair to say, you know, I'll be the devil's advocate. I'll say, well, you know, the wife is always going to get the child, right? Is that, Dominic, is that an old way of thinking? Is it a modern way of thinking? Is that the realistic way of thinking? What is it, you know? Because, you know, you tell people that, you know, they have equal rights, they all tell me that, you know, it's a nice legal concept, but the reality is not true. Is this an old way of thinking of things again? What do you see in your practice?
Well, there are, in fact, equal rights. The law does not distinction, other than definition purpose, of between a mother and a father, you know, a husband and wife, who's a better parent. It's basically dealing with what is in the best interest of that child, and if that parent can show his or her ability to take care of the child, the environment the child is going is. The issue of custody, the issue of access, and the environment where that person has been raised, and a proper plan to raise these children, doesn't have to be feminine or masculine. You know,
right.
It's either, you know, in favor. It'll go to who is the best parenting, you know, parent.
Yeah, and so would you say though that there is a bit of a trend, which maybe societally speaking was not as prevalent, you know, 40 years ago. That the courts more or less feel that if you have a child together with someone, you have an equal right and obligation, right, to do what's in the best interest of the child. And therefore, would you say that there is a tendency on the courts to try to see if a couple can, in fact, do what is in the best interest of the child by still being involved in all major decisions, or perhaps living not just with one parent and the other parent just seeing the child once a month or something like that?
Well, there is different forms of custody and with different forms of access, like joint custody, sole custody, shared custody, split custody. But even in a separation agreement, or even the courts will, in the separation, lawyers who get involved, or mediators, in particular, say lawyers, will try to come to grips through instructions received from the respective clients, husband and wife, how to best serve the needs and carry out your obligations towards the children, joint decision making on education, health, medical reasons, emergencies, who's going to, and access, right? So there have been situations where 1 week the father has a child, and the second week the father has a child,
right,
on a very shared custody.
Right.
That would also affect the quantum of support, right? Mm-hmm. That is to be paid. So there's a lot of variables that come in, but variables that are looking at the child's best interests also, even now, on issues of mobility, schooling, education, etc.
Now, Dominic, as you and I both know, when this major decision is made, perhaps to separate, which will impact greatly on the children, everybody is really involved in the short term, right? As how they feel immediately when your emotions are raw and, you're not a good father, you go bowling every Friday night, you never take the kids, and da-da-da-da-da, you're not worthy enough to be the father and take parental responsibility. You don't know how to make anything except flip hamburgers on a grill. You know, so we hear all these silly things that happen, but, you know, so we look at it, but how do you deal with it? Because there's the short-term aspect, which I agree with you, and that usually gets incorporated into a legal document called the separation agreement, right? Yeah. I saw one last week, you know, as I do property law, and I was asked to handle a transfer of some properties, and because I don't do this every day, you know, and I don't see it every day. And when I actually had to review the separation agreement, and it was like, it was like reading a book from the Bible or college, you know. I mean, it was just incredible, all the things that it was highly, highly structured. Once again, because there was a division, there was obviously the short-term, long-term interplay. You could see it in the document, and the people had their own lawyers and who would stay with whom and when they would go and the holidays. And of course, living here in Canada, we often see that we oftentimes don't come from the same cultural background, perhaps not from the same economic class, perhaps not even from the same religion. And so there are all these things in the short term and long term. And I was looking at the separation agreement thinking, well, this is all very great on the short term, but you can see that there are still the raw, when you talk with the client, you can still see there's still the raw short-term issue from this thing. But what about the longer-term interest of the child itself?
Well, and when I talk, even if I look at the short-term, some clients do come in emotionally disturbed when whether one spouse or one partner has been found committing adultery, or there has been physical and mental abuse. Towards the spouse or towards the children. At that time, certain things need to be happened. You know, it's not a time, to sit back and analyze, but sometimes it's a time that you have to act on a short-term basis, whether it's by way of an application and you get your next party order until things cool down a little bit.
So but some of those models that you mentioned about reconciliation or maybe even family mediation.
Yeah, but let me say this though. Reconciliation part of divorce, all right? There are certain rights. Just if there's been a marriage breakdown, it's not necessarily concomitantly is going to end up in divorce. I mean, there could be certain things such as if there has been a physical abuse that an application can be brought, or there is a question or a period of time where a spouse is not providing child support or support, applications are brought, right? And those are proceedings that may lead to divorce, but it's an immediate proceeding to prevent harm from happening, right? So,
that's the real short-term.
That's a short-term. In the long-term, when you're dealing with this, it is great that people, at least they should consider entering into possibly if they're into a domestic contract, we call it as a separation agreement. Mm-hmm. If it's a first or second marriage contracts, or even a prenuptial contract, so a separation agreement, especially when there are children, if there's, we're talking now marriage breakdown. So the one way of the normalizing this is by entering into a separation agreement where the terms and conditions of how these two, how this couple is going to continue their lives during this period of time for the best interest of the child. And you have custody provisions in there, and you have access provisions as well as support.
Well, a lot of the stuff is short term, so you don't see any long term matters that go into a separation agreement that says something like, and when our son and daughter get married 15 years from now, you will not contest our mutual right to walk our child down the aisle or something.
Well,
like that.
You know, I have yet to put that down, all right? But it might be an obligation that the daughter or son may want that to happen on the day of their specific wedding. Mm-hmm. But you can go as long-term because the separation agreement, a child is dependent on a under the Divorce Act,
right?
So long as he or she is a minor in full-time attendance at an educational institution, or
so it's
suffering
not just
from
the
physical
age of 18, you could be like 24, 25.
It could be 23 if you're going to medical school, etc. All right. So after that, I mean, we all have the right to become independent adults, full-time, etc., unless there's a disability or an inability to do so. So for that period of time, those matters are addressed, whether it's, for example, on registered educational savings plans, you know, and how to deal with it and mm-hmm. how to split that, you know.
Now, Dominic, a lot of things that, once again, this is maybe a function of, you know, in the media and what gets, you know, the Hollywood stars and what they argue about. But people sometimes also, another comment I've heard very often would be the classic, I'll call it sexist attitude. The wife took him for a ride. She got everything, you know. Mm-hmm. This whole question of what is an amount that's proper for either a spouse or a child? So, first of all, on the spouse, I mean, I guess a lot depends on the circumstances of the case.
That's right.
But would it be fair to say that the Family Law Act, once it recognizes that there's basically an irreconcilable difference and people have to move on to their lives, mm-hmm. that the people are encouraged to be as independent as they can?
Well, that is the long-term scope, all right? Yeah. That's why, example, spousal support is, they say it's, is it indefinite or definite, you know? Right. Sometimes it's for certain periods of time, yeah. with the idea that that individual, if she or he can become independent, right?
Yeah, so that might be a short-term issue for like, I mean, if you were married for a short number of years, but if you've been married for 40 years and, yeah. you know, you want to divorce your wife, you're probably looking at a more substantial,
yeah,
if you were the principal breadwinner, let's say.
That's right.
Traditionally.
That's right. But so there are, though, guidelines in child support, for example.
Yeah, I was going to say, for child support, yeah. what...
You the know, child support, there are child support guidelines,
yeah.
where based on, you know, the famous 150 on the income tax return, what is your gross income
on the payer,
be feminine or masculine.
Right, right.
Because it could happen that the person who's paying spousal support is the mother, or it could be the father, depending on their income.
Right.
It also, though, it's based sometimes, most often, on special extraordinary expenses such as education. Medical provisions;
mm-hmm.
those are usually based on the proportionate incomes of the parties,
right.
and those are extra that needs to be addressed.
Yeah. So, is there also a question of want versus need?
Yes.
I'm thinking, practically speaking. So,
it's
you know, my wife might think, I'll just use her as an example, mm-hmm. but I'll say any spouse might think, well, you know. I think the kids should go to De La Salle College. I'm sorry if our Catholic listeners will take offense at this, but they shouldn't be. I just use De La Salle because it's a well-known, or St. Mike's, a well-known Catholic high school. And
sure. You went to De La Salle?
No, I went to St. Jerome's High School.
I went to St. Michael's. Okay.
Okay. We'll pick on De La Salle, you know? So let's say someone from De La Salle and One of the spouses thinks, well, it's going to cost $25,000 a year. I don't know what it costs now, but let's say $20,000, $25,000. And the other spouse says, are you crazy? $20,000, $25,000. So there might be a want or a need, but I mean a want, but is there a need to do it? How do you find those kinds of issues?
Well, you know, a court would look, or even a lawyer would look, or even a mediator, an arbitrator or something, is what is a standard of living?
Yeah, so what's
what was
the standard
it before?
Of living right now?
What was it before, and what is it now, right? And in proportion sometimes to income.
Yeah, and is it realistic maybe?
That's right? So you got to be really realistic on it, if I can give you that. And in separation agreements, we lawyers should be encouraged to put a dispute resolution so that they have an opportunity first to discuss between the parties, involve their lawyers, and if necessary, then mediate or arbitrate. Because going to court, it is a very expensive and costly matter as well as traumatic.
I was going to say, I think that's a comment that I've heard very often as a non-practicing family lawyer, because I think, as you mentioned, the emotions short-term are so raw. There's this perception that the other person has somehow taken advantage of some situation, or there's maybe a failure to be honest and disclose assets, for example.
Well, if I may address that, lawyers, when they enter into, we go through the reconciliation stage, the parties are really at not at Edom in Latin, they're not meeting of the minds, and they've made their decision to divorce. There is a form, or there is a financial thing. There needs to be financial disclosure. So all the cards are laid on the table. And if you're not really doing honestly, or you're not disclosing your significant assets and debts, whatever you've signed could be set aside. So there's no fooling around, really. I mean, you got to say what your expenses are, what your assets are, what your liabilities are, and you reach at the end what is called
a compromise. A settlement. Yeah, I was going to say, unfortunately, over the years, I always thought it was good I was not a family law judge, because I would be what they probably call a hard guy, a hard, tough guy, because I think a lot of times people like to play these little mind games with people. And we're talking about what's in the best interest of the child. And of course, they sometimes use the children or money as a way of expressing their anger or disappointment over this relationship that has failed. And it's easy to say, but sometimes it manifests itself. People can't help themselves on the short term. Right. And whereas in the longer term, we see things, seem to chill out a little bit, and people can maybe, let's say, peacefully coexist over a longer term situation.
That's correct. But one keep in mind, Joseph, is that I have involved through the court system use of the children's lawyer, official children's lawyer.
Yes.
And they can be ordered by the court to be involved to represent the interests of the child, especially when there is manipulation, alienation,
right? Because we talked about the
brainwashing.
The courts, which is the government of Ontario, is a judicial arm, basically says we want to do what's in the best interest of the child, and we may not think that you, Mr. and Mrs. Spouse, are necessarily the best person to deal for what's in the best interest of the child, and they get involved. So they have that authority sitting in the background. People don't realize it.
Yeah, they have that, or it could be made consensual between the two parties to have an appointment so that the child has representation in court and the feelings are expressed. Who do I want to? Why do I want to?
Another thing, Dominic, just to bring it full circle, because I actually was reading something a couple weeks ago. I believe there's going to be a new revision to the Family Law Act coming forward after... Gosh, I guess we're talking, 38 years, 40 years roughly from the old law. And so let's say 40 years on, there's, of course, laws need to be updated and so on. And one of the things that struck me, and I've seen this, unfortunately, this family dynamic, and that is, and I'm sure there are listeners listening to us today who are a lot older, and what they perceive while their children are fighting and the grandchildren are the object of their lack of harmony, is that the grandparents are left out in the cold. And I must admit, I've never seen a separation agreement that dealt with grandparents, quite unquote.
No, I've done that recently a couple of times.
Because, but I must tell you that it is a something that has been expressed to me innumerable times, not talking about family law matters. You know, you might be talking about a transfer of a property, you're setting up a will, or a series of wills or estates planning for a couple, and then they're a little bit older, and then they say, oh, yes, and my, you know, my son is divorced, and, you know, and, you know, my relationship with my grandchildren, my former daughter-in-law, she didn't think I was a good grandchild, a good grandparent, or whatever. She thinks her parents are better than us, and all this stuff that comes out. And I'm just wondering, since you've had the experience, what about grandparents? Like what are they? Are they just, you know, they had their go at it years ago, and
if you throw them aside? If I may, on a recent question of in a separation agreement where the grandparents came, where family members played an important role, was in the event one parent, during the access period, could not take care of that child.
Okay.
Then the following procedure will take place. They will first, the caregiver will first option to a family member, grandparent. Right?
Right.
Secondly, to a mutually known friend.
Right.
Thirdly, to an adult, keeping in mind the best interests of the child, and at all times giving the name, telephone number, and contact information. Right?
Right.
Now, at the beginning of this session, I quoted something that is of the preamble of the family law. And it says, whereas it is desirable to encourage and strengthen the role of the family.
Yeah.
So what family is not just, I would say, you know,
mother and father.
Mother and father. I mean, the grandparents and the courts are beginning to see the importance of their role, you know?
Yeah. What we used to call the extended family.
Extended family. Yeah. Family.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear, because I must admit that this is always
And they really have it at heart. I mean, they really care for the children, provided that they don't become adversarial and
Correct.
Be manipulated.
Right,
because
right.
that will only hurt, you know, and put more wedge between the two.
Well, I do know that in this context, where we've seen it very often, is where there's a feeling from the grandparents that if something goes to their son or daughter, that A, it becomes automatically the property of maybe even that spouse or whatever. And this is sometimes how things come up, where there's maybe problems with the marriage, you know, and then they're concerned, what happens in the future if I leave half of my estate to my daughter and she's in an abusive relationship? Is he going to be able to do? And,
right.
you know, we get into all the routines. So, and that's where a lot of this comes out, because, and that's where the issues arise. And what's going to happen?
It becomes adversarial.
It becomes very adversarial, even before maybe they, the couple themselves, have, let's say, taken steps perhaps to disassociate from themselves.
Right.
And of course, there's the whole emotional involvement, because the other, I think, a fair comment to make, that the way parents treat grandchildren is very different than where they treated their own parents, right?
Yeah. Well, I've recently...
And there's this whole bonding aspect. Yeah. And as an older person, to have a bonding relationship with a grandchild that tomorrow is threatened, I think basically shakes people to their core, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've, in the last 3 years, I've become a grandparent 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I say they should pass a new commandment, you know? Thou shalt live until one experiences grandparenthood, at least. And the love of a grandparent towards a child is unsurmountable. It's there.
Mm.
But just like the grandparent and the parent, they got to keep an open mind. They got to see what there's a reasonable sound this, and not put division. Put peace in it, you know, but unfortunately, it is the courts appear, not a courts appear, some people look at the courts adversarial. It is there to try to make a decision, a reasonable and fair and just decision in the circumstances.
Well, Thank you, Dominic. I think this has been a really informative on both a personal and legal basis.
It's been my pleasure.
And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and, of course, your thoughts and experience with all of our listeners today as they see how this legal aspect of life has direct impact on their day-to-day life. And so leaving that as we may, Dominic of Dominic Campione, Barristers and Solicitors, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us today. We hope maybe in the future, if there's another topic relating to law that would be of interest, we'd be love to have you again in the studio to really inform all of our listeners. Thank you so much, Dominic.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello, here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.